Bill 400, and I'm going to ask for 401 testimony at the same time. Okay, so public hearing on Senate Bills 400 and 401. Good afternoon. Would you please identify yourself to the committee and proceed?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tracy Loudon. I am the Fiscal and Performance Manager for the Employment Department. I'm here this afternoon to speak to you about Senate Bill 400. A 1990 report by the Legislative Fiscal Office recognized the importance of data collection, reporting, and evaluation regarding the many programs that make up the state's workforce development system. To meet this need, the 1993 legislature enacted Senate Bill 81 that created the Shared Information System. A consortium of education and workforce agencies designed the Shared Information System as a tool for analyzing the performance of the state's workforce system. In brief, the Shared Information System was designed to develop accurate, timely, and unbiased economic and workforce-related information regarding the overall performance of Oregon's combined workforce and educational training system. The system is operated at the Employment Department and compiles aggregate information about individuals receiving services from several workforce agencies. Senate Bill 400 would modify current law by changing the current Shared Information System to specify which agencies must participate and including stronger safeguards for handling information about individuals. It will also allow the department to establish a new performance information system that will eventually replace the Shared Information System. The new system would provide required federal, state, and local performance measure data. This new system will collect, analyze, and share statistical and demographic data for the development and reporting of workforce system performance measures from the Federal Workforce Investment Act of 1998 and for Oregon's comprehensive workforce system-wide performance indicators. This enhanced system would, among other things, expand data capture and reporting capabilities established by the Shared Information System, provide online ability to generate standard or customized reports at state, agency, and regional levels for 14 system-wide performance indicators adopted by Oregon's Workforce Investment Board, and enable aggregate or individual information access by partners. Senate Bill 400 includes strict confidentiality requirements on the handling of any individual information. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I anticipate your lively discussion on this.
Thank you very much, Tracy. We are now ready for a lively discussion. Does anyone have any questions for Tracy? Okay. Hearing none, I think you explained it very well. You did a good job, Nathan.
So, Mr. Chair, just one question. Yeah. How many agencies will this affect then?
Mr. Chair, yes. Senator Nelson, the number of agencies that will affect is dependent upon those that want to participate. There are six that are listed specifically with other participating agencies that might also want to join.
I'd say eight or six. Okay. All right. Graham. Oh, no. Brad, excuse me.
I am Graham, Mr. Chair.
You're Graham, yes. You're right.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Graham Slater, and I'm the research manager at the Employment Department, and I'm here to speak about Senate Bill 401. Would you like me to move to that one?
Go ahead. Okay. You do it 400 and 401 vote.
Members of the committee, for 401, you do have a letter from our director, Verlina Crosley, formally testifying on this. Also, you have this handout which says labor market information, and that's really what I'll be stepping through with you this afternoon. I also provided you with two other documents that I'll refer to briefly. One is this careers newspaper, mm-hmm. and the other is some pictures from our website, if you will, relating to occupational information. Under the Workforce Investment Act, the governor of every state was required to designate an employment statistics entity for their state. And in this state, as in fact all others, the Employment Department's research section was the designated agency. Similarly, under the Carl Perkins amendments, which relate to education and professional technical education in particular, the governor and the State Board of Education were required to designate an occupational information entity. The Department's research section was chosen for that entity. The Employment Department, as some of you may know, has long had the responsibility for labor market information in the state. And I've listed some examples of what that means. Unemployment rates, employment by industry. Examples would be, how do we know that some parts of the state are worse off economically than others? Well, it's because of unemployment rates by county. It's because we know that the trends in high tech are upwards and lumber employment is downwards. Those all come from our statistics. We also publish numbers on occupational growth so that young people and even adults changing careers know which are the growing and declining occupations. We have wage information, educational information, skills information, And I would just like to highlight at the bottom of that section that we do produce all of this, not just for Oregon as a state, but at the regional and county level also, so that wherever you happen to be, you've got relevant information for your area. Now, this occupational program planning system is just one small part of our research section, but it has specific responsibility for the long and short range occupational projections of demand. In other words, how many jobs will there be, what do employers need, and the supply. How many workers are there going to be, how many graduates from the schools and the colleges. I want to just share with you very briefly, again, this careers publication, which is one example just so that you know what this system is that we're talking about. This goes to all high schools, community colleges, workforce partners. 160,000 copies are distributed annually. And this year, for the first time, we also published it in Spanish. And right in the middle, you'll just see examples of the kind of information that we're talking about for any given occupation. What is the outlook? How many jobs are there? Where can you go to get training? And so on. The other handout that I gave you is these things from the Oregon Labor Market Information System. It's our website. Won several national awards, but one of the options there is called an Occupational Information Center, and that's the one that shows on the first page. If you just quickly would like to step through that with me, you can see that we can do on page 2 a search for any keyword, and we chose emergency. So on page 3 we find a whole lot of information on emergency medical technicians, and you can see there that it's anything from job descriptions to wages to licensing information. In fact, the very first screen that someone gets when they click on that is a screen with today's current job openings that are listed at the employment department. But if they keep moving through the screens, they can find out what the license entails, what they need to do to go get a license. The next page tells them where the jobs are and whether there are more in some regions than others, whether they're growing faster in some regions than others. The next one on page 7 tells them the wages for this occupation. Page 8 tells the folks the Oregon skill sets, and for every one of the 800 occupations, we prepare skill sets that employers say they need. These are just the first few for an EMT. The next page tells them what occupations are similar to an EMT, because maybe you can't find a job as that right now, but there are other things that are very similar that you'd be well qualified for. Page 10 tells them which industries they should be looking in to find jobs. That helps it narrow down. And the last couple of pages tell them where they can go to get the training and give the user a direct link to the community college or the university or the private school that provides that training. The final thing that OPPS is very heavily used for is by the community colleges and other private schools to determine should they even start a new program of training, because they want to know, will there be demand for these workers once we're all done training these folks. So Senate Bill 401, now that you know the background, would do four main things. It would consolidate all the language relating to this program into the Employment Department Statute 657, and it would remove that language from ORS 329, which is often known as the Educational Act for the 21st century. It was put there by legislative council several sessions back and has always been there, but in that original law, it specifies that all of the activity takes place in the Employment Department's research section. And so this has just been one of those quirks that's hung out there for a number of years. It would also give the director of the employment department oversight and control of the system, and I'll explain why we think that's important in a second. And finally, it would remove reference to two completely obsolete, defunct entities that no longer exist. They did exist when this was first written, but either for federal reasons or because of the shared information system that you've just heard about, these programs, the Occupational Information Coordinating Committee and the Automated Follow-Up System, no longer exist.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my question, I guess, how the connection between this and the shared information systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. In the very early years of the idea to be able to track people after they left the workforce or education system and see how they performed in jobs, in wages, and retention, there was a pilot, really, called the Oregon Automated Follow-Up System that the Employment Department put together. It was very much the precursor to the shared information system. And once the shared information system came into full being, this Oregon follow-up system really did disappear. We have no staffing for it, we have no FTE, and it hasn't existed actually for about 3 or 4 years now. But it was part of this bill, as the old law at the time. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
The changes that we're recommending, mostly therefore, are what you might call cleanup. They're removing references literally to things that no longer exist. The old statute did talk about the OPPS, the Program Planning System, having direction and control from this state occupational information coordinating council, but it no longer exists. And in reality, at least for the last few years, it really didn't give much direction anyway. But at this point, as of about a year ago, it literally doesn't exist. So the changes, we believe, reflect the current reality of how OPPS has worked in the last few years. It has always been part of the research section at the Employment Department, and even the old statute says that that's where it will be housed. It hasn't been given policy direction from the Occupational Coordinating Committee or from the Governor's Education or Workforce Policy Advisors, although we work very closely with them. And as I said, the follow-up responsibilities were absorbed into the shared information system. I do want to let you know that the Employment Department does lead a quarterly group called the Partnership for Occupational and Career Information, and the membership of that group includes representation from the Department of Education, Department of Workforce, Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and Oregon's Career Information System, which is out of the University of Oregon. So we are still leading the group that makes sure we're not duplicating, that we are communicating and coordinating. We did discuss the bill very early last year with representatives from all those agencies and the governor's office also, and they've all agreed to it and support it, and we don't expect any problems, you know, from other people that would see this as a negative thing. So thank you for the opportunity to share the information.
Okay, thank you very much, Pam. Questions for Mr. Sayer? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Brad Swank from the in Senate Bill 400. From the state court system. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Duncan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office, and I didn't come here with a position on the bill. I just came with an issue that I thought I would raise for you in relation to Senate Bill 400 that we found to be an issue in relation to some of the databases that we deal with. If you look at page one of the bill, one of the things that they're adding in line 22 is the ability to analyze information that they get. And one of the things that we have found in terms of shared databases is that when you analyze data, you actually create a new form of data. And this is, and it's the analyzed data. You may be analyzing confidential data, but you can extract from that information which may not in itself be confidential. For instance, in the state court, all of the records dealing with mental commitments are confidential unless released by a judge. But if we analyze that data to find out how many people were committed in a particular county in a particular year, that information wouldn't be confidential, because it doesn't reveal the individual information about the people. So that information would have its separate place, that compiled information analyzed would have its separate place in under the public records law. That's important in terms of knowing who the custodian is of particular information. When you've got a shared database between a number of agencies like you do here, and you're going to be generating compiled information and analysis of information, you've got to know, the public has to know who is the custodian for purposes of trying to get the compiled information, and if there's ever a challenge made under the public records law, the courts have to know who didn't carry out their duty to provide the information. And when I looked at this bill, it was not, I was looking at page 2, lines 23 through 25, and it said the interagency shared information system is not the custodian of information for purposes of the public records law. The Employment Department shall refer all requests for disclosure of public records to the participating state agency or organization requesting the report. Well, if this only works on the basis of they only provide reports when it's requested by specific agencies, that would work. But if they do compilations or analysis separate from that, it leaves open the question of who is the custodian for purposes of that analyzed information. Like I say, we don't have a position on this. I just thought I would raise the issue as something that you might want to consider. It may be covered in the bill, but I looked hard in the bill to find out where it was covered as to who was the custodian of that compiled information if there wasn't a specific report requested, thinking that it might be an issue you would want to cover so that it's not left and you don't have unintended consequences if it ends up in court about not knowing who's supposed to give up the information. That's the sole reason I'm here. I don't know whether we would ever be a participating agency in this. I noticed on page 1, line 17 through 20, talks about any other government organization. I don't know if that would eventually be us or not, but in terms of the custodian of the public records, that may just be an issue, and it may be covered in here. It may be intended that it's handled through the agreements.
Tracy, can you respond to that? All right, we'll just let you stay up here. We'll just deal with that right now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Tracy Loudon of the Employment Department. Thank you for the question. That has come up as an issue of who is the custodian of the aggregate information. And the way that the Employment Department has handled this question is that the information, as it deals with statewide matters where we're reporting on the entire workforce system, that is something that there's not necessarily a custodian or owner of that. It's public information. But if the information that is being put together in aggregate that applies to a particular agency, that agency is the custodian of record for that information. And we have approached the Attorney General's office on that and have had that ruling on that matter.
You have comments on that?
The only comment is when he says that it's the reason for having a custodian under the public records law is to know who to request the information from.
Mm-hmm.
And if he says there is no custodian, it's public information, it's the question is, okay, so if we want the information, who do we ask? And if there's something that's resolved by an Attorney General's opinion, I'm happy to get it on the record. It was just a question that came up. I thought you would like to know, and we certainly would like for it not to be an unresolved question if it's brought up in court.
Other questions from committee members?
Well, other than I agree.
Can I offer just a little bit more clarification? Thank you for that. Because we do, the Employment Department does need to take ownership of that. And we actually have a website where the Shared Information System report is published so that people can see that aggregate statewide information. So we would be that custodian of record, the director of the Employment Department. And that is, I would say, is made much more clear in the change that we're asking for in Senate Bill 400, because it makes the director of the Employment Department the administrator of the Shared Information System.
I'm wondering if we wouldn't be smart to ask you folks to go back and work together with the AG and just check it out, and then you may have some other language you want to bring. Committee members, any comments? Senator Courtney, are you comfortable with that?
I apologize. I know that I always, when I bring up these esoteric questions, Senator Courtney always looks at me like I'm nuts, and I apologize.
Well, we'd rather catch things now
than
later. Anybody else? Oh, Grattan, did you want to testify on this bill?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, Grattan Sarris, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Emergency System, and you have a packet in the material that was presented. The participating agencies, ours didn't arrive in time to be as aggregated with those among the data given to you for the bill. I'm here for the record to say that as one of the participating agencies, we are in support of the bill. The Chancellor has signed the agreement for the new shared information system. We look forward to going forward with it.
Okay, thank you very
well
much. Anyone else want to testify on either Senate Bills 400 or 401? Okay, at this point, then what we'll be doing, and you folks will be going back and looking at that language. I think maybe I'll hold both bills for work session a little bit later. So I'm going to close the public hearing, and we'll get it back on the schedule for the work session after you've done some work on that. Okay, closing the public hearing on Senate Bills 400 and 401. I'm opening a public hearing on... And again, I'm going to take three bills, Senate Bill 101, 102, and Senate Joint Resolution 17. Senator Hartog.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Tom Hartung, Senator from District 3. I appreciate your courtesy to allow me to have 1 minute on each bill, Senate Bill 101 and Senate Bill 102, SJR 17, are really great opportunities for us to grow our economy, but what's most important is to make our institutions of higher education truly world-class. I think of what Senator Courtney has said a number of times on the floor in this first session of this new millennium. We have some opportunities. We have some responsibilities to do things that we don't normally do in the course of business, or certainly haven't done in the sessions that I've been here, with a few exceptions. But those three bills are related, and I've worked diligently with those issues for the last 6 years since I came back to the Senate after being gone 14 years. And you have behind me here people who have spent a tremendous amount of time working on these bills and this concept. And Senator Nelson knows as much as anybody in this room about the technology transfer part of it and how important that is if we truly are going to develop some world-class research and engineering universities. And with the merger now of the Oregon Health Science University, I think we call it now Oregon Health and Sciences University, and OGI, and we have a wonderful opportunity to do some extraordinary things. So thank you for the time, and I know that you have enough resources behind me here that you'll do an outstanding job. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Hartung? Thank you very much for being with us today, Senator. Okay, I'm going to ask Diane Vines and Bill Scott and Jim Conan to come forward for the presentation on. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. Oh, and we have a fourth person.
We understand. Yes, I've invited John Van Leeuwenhoek to join us. He's going to be on the second group providing testimony, but John is the president of the Oregon University System Board. So I wanted him to be up here with us.
Excuse me, just 10 yes. seconds. We have other.
The kids have joined us. They're observing.
What school do you know? Okay, we have a number of students who have joined us this afternoon. What school?
Highland Park
School. I understand that's the home school of Senator Deckard, right? Okay. We'd like to welcome you to the committee, and this is a Senate committee. A bill first comes to the committee. If it survives here, it goes to the floor of the Senate. If it doesn't survive here, you may never hear of it again. But I think you're going to hear some interesting testimony this afternoon. Welcome to the committee. We're glad to have you guys here. Remember, Senator Mark Hatfield came to visit the Capitol one day and decided he liked this place and came back as a representative, senator, governor, and stayed for a long time. So who knows? We may have the future governor of Oregon sitting in the room today. Welcome. Okay, go right ahead.
Thank you, Senator Duncan. For the record, my name is Diane Vines. I'm vice chancellor for corporate and public affairs for the Oregon University System. I think all of you pretty well, but we're here today to speak about these bills and to also place them in the context. There's one bill that was heard yesterday by Senate Education Committee that we are also going to discuss because it relates to a package of bills, really, that we hope you'll consider. You will also be hearing later, I think on March 1st, you won't, Senate Education will be hearing on March 1st, the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Account bill. And so we've included information about that because, again, we feel this is a continuum of bills. I'd first like to start with a little bit of history, and I'll ask my colleagues when they go to present to introduce themselves. A little bit of history on how we got here. Originally, a couple of years ago, the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative focused on several items, but one of them was how to better involve higher education in creating a climate for entrepreneurship in the state. As a result of that, we formed with the governor's support, the Economic Development Joint Board's working group. And that working group, and you have in front of you a PowerPoint presentation that you can follow about this, that working group was asked by the governor to focus on three areas. One was to increase research funding for research and development in the state. The second was to increase the amount of knowledge exchange that was going on between the public and private colleges and universities and business and industry and economic development activities. The third was to look at what were emerging industry clusters that the state should pay attention to and how the state might best assist those. We identified the biosciences, and you'll hear, I think, more and more about the biosciences as a potential industry to supplement the high technology industry for the state. And of course, the e-commerce activities out of the Internet Commission are another emerging industry for the state. The governor appointed representatives from the State Board of Higher Ed for the Oregon University System campuses, the State Board of Education for the community colleges, the Economic and Community Development Commission, and some independent college trustees to study how best to link higher education to economic development activities. The legislation that came out of that was reported to him in June of 2000, and he agreed to forward those pieces of legislation for us to work with you on behalf of those pieces of legislation. The first bill will be talked about by Bill Scott.
Okay. I'm Bill Scott, for the record. I'm the director of the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and I'd like to maybe take this opportunity to thank the Board of Higher Education and Chancellor Cox and Diane and Chancellor Cox for recruiting Diane into this position, that since I think it represents a commitment that we didn't used to have from the state of the Oregon University system to really be part of the economic development efforts of the state. And it's been a tremendous partnership for us, and I think has created a sort of other sources of energy around economic development that we didn't have before. And it's really created a lot of momentum, and we're very grateful for that. The I'll just briefly mention this piece of legislation. This bill is not before you, but what we realized besides the specific recommendations that came out of the Joint Board's working group that Diane just talked about was that these would probably be only a few of many initiatives that we would want to discuss and issues that we would want to resolve over the years in bringing the intellectual capacity of the state and the economic capacity of the state into conjunction and really leveraging off each other. So that one thing we needed was, rather than just dealing with kind of this biennium's opportunities or issues, was an ongoing forum where we could, as a matter of course, build into our policy infrastructure a focus on the connection between knowledge and the economy. That's the point of creating the Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, is really to look at those opportunities and issues as they come along. The bill was heard yesterday in the Senate Education Committee, and it's pretty straightforward. It is a governor-appointed council that would have a regular staggered membership represented, similar to the Joint Board's working group, by representatives of economic development, the business community, and all the sectors of higher education and community colleges in the state. So the point of that bill is just to create an ongoing effort. I think both higher education and economic development and the Office of Community Colleges understand we already have staff working on these policy issues. This is just a way of focusing their efforts so that we're not asking for any budget differently. We'll staff it with the resources we have.
Thank you. Next on your handout, your presentation, you'll see that we tried to summarize for you what the situation is in terms of commercializing intellectual assets that are developed by colleges and universities in the state, and why we think this is an important issue for the state's economic development. If you look at our university research and development budgets, the amount of money coming into the universities, this is not state dollars. These are generally federal dollars. They're also sometimes private sector dollars. Our research faculty in the state are very productive faculty. They're inventive and creative, and they're bringing in, if you look at the research funding per faculty member, the invention disclosures, and the patents that are developed, we're quite competitive even with the big guys, which are North Carolina, Texas, Washington, and California. We tried to give you some aspirational peers, not peers that we would ordinarily be compared to. If you look at the next slide, you'll see, however, that licensing as a source of revenue that results from these kinds of activities is it's not very remunerative, and we are not doing that well in that case, because we have no technology transfer dollars that the state puts toward this effort. So those ideas just languish and either go out of state and get commercialized out of state and benefit those states and not ours, or they sit there and they go back into the public domain. So if you look at licenses per 100 million in research and the revenue per license, we are quite low compared to some of these other states. If you look at the next slide, it's another worrisome thing for Oregon because we rely so heavily for economic development activities on small businesses and emerging growth companies, startups. And if you look at then, so we don't have many licenses, and the fraction of licenses that are commercialized in the state by large companies is great and very low for small companies and startups. This led us to look at whether we should allow campuses to hold stock. If you can hold equity instead of licensing it out, it's a much greater source of, there's much more incentive for the researcher and the campus to commercialize their ideas, and much greater return to the state in terms of creation of wealth and good jobs. So the next slide, SJR 17, would allow for a constitutional amendment to be put to the voters that would allow public institutions to hold stock. This includes community colleges and Oregon University System campuses. About 50% of the states in the country already allow this and have found it very profitable for their economic development activities. And several of the states are also looking to us for leadership in how to do this when they don't have that opportunity. Jim's now going to talk about a couple of the other bills.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Jim Coonan. I'm Director of Business Alliances for the Oregon University System. And the next bill is SB 102, Higher Education Technology Transfer Account. This is really a backup, if you will, to the constitutional amendment. Our primary goal is to get the constitutional amendment passed. However, although we know of no known opposition to it, what we are concerned about is through the initiative process that it might get lost. And we're not sure also from the timing standpoint about how quickly that might happen. This bill would allow campuses to hold stock through a mechanism that would be established at the end of the legislative session. And the way that this would work is, first off, and just to underline it, it doesn't require constitutional change. But what it would do is allow creation of an account within the Education Endowment Fund. That's currently available already to the Oregon Growth Account, you may be familiar with, and also the Oregon Research and Technology Development Account. So this would create an account within that fund, which already has a constitutional exception, and it would thus, through that vehicle, be able to hold stock. This bill would sunset if the constitutional amendment passes. So we wouldn't have duplicative legislation out there. Page 13 is just a brief schematic of how that would work and showing this account is kind of a holding place for campuses to hold stock. I should also add, this was drafted for us by Department of Justice, and we also had input from the Treasury. And we can also say this will not endanger any of the university's connections with their foundations. So if they choose to continue their relationships with foundations, this is totally at their own option and would not create any problems for them from that standpoint. On page 14, SB 101 is the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund, and this arose out of a subgroup that came out of the Joint Boards Working Group that Diane talked to you about. And this was a combination of business and academic leaders. And as Diane mentioned, although we are doing an increasingly good job in terms of research and development, the amount of dollars that are being applied to the area of technology transfer are very small. And just as one example, Oregon State last year had over 100 information or discoveries. However, they were only able to afford to patent two or three of those, just simply because they didn't have the funds to do that. So what this group proposed is developing a fund that can apply dollars to these areas and transfer dollars to campuses in order to achieve this technology transfer. Page 15 gives you a summary of some of what those activities are. I mentioned the patent activities, but it could also be used in terms of applied research, prototype development, beta testing, or even just putting gas in the car to go visit a company to initiate some of these discussions. We know as part of this research that looking at a lot of other states, and Don Van Leeuwen may comment on this later, that a lot of other states are looking at investing dollars in this area, and we think that this is an important provision. Page 16 is a brief schematic, and the only thing I'll point out about this is that the fund is what I refer to as an omnivore fund. It can take money from anywhere. You can take money from the legislator. It can take money from also private foundations. So it can take it from a multiple of sources. And it would then distribute funds to campuses for them to help commercialize that research. Page 17 is a brief summary of some of the specifics, five to seven member board appointed by the governor. May report to the successor organization that Bill Scott talked about, and it can appoint advisory scientific committees to help it in terms of its work, be staffed by the OUS Office of the Chancellor. And then again, it talks a little bit about the dollars could be directed to both independent, not just the big research guys, but also the independent and smaller public campuses, and significantly to campuses throughout the state of Oregon. So we really see this as a bill that can help the entire state. If there's research going on in eastern Oregon, this is a vehicle to help with the activities that are going on out there. Page 18, briefly, the longer-term funding for this is probably better established than the short-term funding. The longer-term funding would come from the declared earnings from the Oregon Growth Account and the Oregon Research and Technology Development Account. Bill Newman will be up here later talking about ORTDA and their support of this. Both boards support the use of these funds to provide the funding for the Tech Transfer Fund. Shorter term, the current bill talks about a dollar appropriation. We'd like to be able to seed this fund with as much as $3 to $5 million. We are also looking at federal avenues for this and other sources as well. Page 19 is kind of my summary schematic for this, and it walks you through the starting from basic research. The next bubble is technology transfer, and that's where this fund comes in to help with this early applied research. And then the next stage takes you into the business creation, and ORTDA that I've mentioned a couple of times is a seed venture fund, and really is unique in the state that they are focused on working with universities to commercialize the research coming out of universities. So we have them as really the only folks that come in. They come in before the venture capital people. But eventually that leads to business creation development and later seed venture and venture funds that come into it. And then the return arrow demonstrates that the declared earnings from those two state funds transfer back to this tech transfer fund. So after we can get this initiated in terms of its funding, it will develop ongoing support through those two funds. Ultimately, we're positioning this as economic development because we believe that more ideas that we can commercialize out of our university system, out of all of our universities, ultimately leads to more jobs and more revenues for the state of Oregon. I should also add that we have given you some amendments that go along with both of these bills, should be in your possession. They are all technical in nature. I'd be happy to go through those if you so desire. Otherwise, I'll just leave that to your reference.
You also have in front of you two reports. One is the report to the governor called Building Bridges to a Knowledge Economy. The other is a report that was done by a consultant who has worked for Battelle, and he summarizes next steps, and these would really go to the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development for their implementation, and also evaluates the whole project as with it gives us an excellent overall evaluation report. We now would like to call some people, if that's okay with you, Senator Duncan.
Yes, this is
some additional
the
people.
Group one testimony.
Yes,
okay.
Group one.
Right. That'd be Don Van Leeuwen. Am I saying it right?
Yes.
Don Kramer, Black Helderline, and Jim Craven. You all come on up. Why don't you go right ahead, Don?
Okay, thank you. Just for the record, my name is Don Van Luveney. I'm the CEO of Electro Scientific Industries, Oregon's oldest technology company. We're nearing 60 years old. And I'm the current president of the State Board of Higher Education. I think the case for having a linked development of intellectual know-how and converting it into economic health for the state has been well stated. But I think there's another issue, that the ability of universities to have some equity interest in this equation is important to discuss. We have bright professors who have a lot of great ideas, and I think it's a combination of the professors and the universities sharing in the 1 out of 10 that can be an economic success that's really at stake here. I find that we have a university system with tremendous capability, but we have professors and we have university leadership that do not believe they can have an opportunity to share in the success. I think that's an error in just general people motivation. I'm not an expert at the laws and the interrelationships of those laws that make it difficult, but I believe as I've studied these, it's similar in thinking to what I've seen in other states. It doesn't make it better or worse, but I think I would be looking for the results here to energize a group of very smart people.
Thank you, folks, thank you for being with us today. Hope you enjoy your visit to Capitol.
It's really a group of very smart people on all sides of this equation. And if we talk about encouraging the universities to commercialize their activity, to link in to the investment capital world that really is the engine that makes it successful, the ability for professors and universities, without changing hats, to have a share in successes, I think is important to encouraging the working together. I think that when we look around, we'll find that there are a few models of this around the country. I happen to have spent 10 years before I came here in Pennsylvania, where they created a set of funds. One fund was really based on funding activity, not to create economic wealth, but to create new jobs. That was the basis. The second fund was really managed by investment bankers, and it was dedicated to making money for the state and investors. And the real issue that made them all work was the engagement of university leadership, of the very smart professors, of the business community, and the financial people that brought extra money to the table. And the net flow was tens of millions of dollars into the state of Pennsylvania. I think we even have a larger opportunity here in Oregon to bring in funds that we can't imagine how much they can be. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions? Yes.
What's the history behind this bill that prohibited the public institutions from owning stock?
I wish I could tell you. I've been here approaching 9 years, and I will tell you that it was only in the last 3 years that I understood they couldn't. And where I've been, and it's East Coast and the Southwest, I found it somewhat strange.
Looks like Don's ready to answer that question.
Senator Nelson, my name is Don Kramer. I'm a partner with Black Elder Line, served as a member of the Joint Board's Working Group, as well as one of the founders of the Oregon Emerging Business Initiative. Plus, I also serve as Special Assistant Attorney General for Department of Justice related to ORTA, and we spent quite a bit of time looking at that issue. Statutorily, or actually in the terms of the Constitution, it dates back really to the 1900s and the railroads. Literally, nationally, there was a thought that we didn't want state governments sort of investing in railroads, and so they literally put that in statute at the time. It was amended to allow universities to hold sort of bequests and gifts, but this area related to tech transfer is really a new one. And nationally, we're seeing, I believe, about half the states have sort of changed their constitutions to allow this to happen. One of the things that we did here in Oregon, and Diane alluded to it, is you want to be real careful when you tinker with that part of the Constitution, because it basically relates to the whole party, the piece of third-party investing by the treasurer, And so we worked, actually worked the treasurer's office to make sure that we had everybody aligned in the right kind of way. So, for the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Don Kramer, as I said before, and I guess I'm here today just to endorse what everybody else has said so far. To me, the way that I look at this, this is really building infrastructure not for our knowledge-based economy, and I've been down here for several sessions sort of beating the drum, but I think this year is the first time that I've really seen a very coordinated effort to do a couple things. And I think the package of bills that have been talked about here, as well as the bill that was presented yesterday, plus the ORTDA bill, presents a real focus in terms of where we're going. If you combine that with what I would sort of say are the four agenda items of the new economy, and Scott Gibson, who testified yesterday, I think sort of said it well. One is we need to develop sort of a top-tier engineering school in the state and dedicate the resources to that. Two is we need to dedicate ourselves to developing sort of world-class education related to sort of biotech and whatnot. And I was with John Castles this morning, and Murdoch Foundation made a $4 million grant, which is the largest grant ever made in the history of the foundation, to further the OSU, Oregon Health Sciences, OGI merger. And so you'll be hearing about that shortly. And then also to double the number of engineering degrees. And then the fourth area is really this area of technology transfer. So I would just urge your support. I think the people behind me and a lot of people not in this room are really willing to sort of go to bat to basically make sure that we've got the infrastructure to implement this if you guys can step up. Of course, the big issue here, particularly with some of these bills, particularly with the higher ed fund, it is going to require a few dollars, and we do need to sort of be creative in terms of how we do that. But I would challenge you that as we sort of look at building, you know, a lot of physical infrastructure around the state, this is knowledge-based infrastructure, and I think we just need to sort of find dollars in this session to sort of help create the platform. It's sort of the glue I see is sort of tying a lot of this stuff together. So with that, we'll turn it over to Mr. Craven unless anyone has any
questions.
Thank
you, Don. Jim?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association, nation's largest high-tech trade association, representing about 165 companies here in Oregon. I'm not going to delay you any further on a Friday afternoon. I think we run the risk of votes going the other direction the longer we speak sometimes. This set of bills does a couple of things. It removes some barriers, like the constitutional barrier that people have said over the years, oh, my God, there's just a barrier to making this work. So we ought to get barriers out of the way. I think the various funds sort of prime the pump. But at the end of the day, I hope, you know, if this whole package moves forward and the voters do what we are going to ask them to do in November of 2002, you know, that you continue to be engaged and watch for results. I mean, these are just process steps here. The ultimate proof in the pudding is whether any of this works and whether we jumpstart some companies and make some money for higher ed and all that. So it is a multi-year process. It's going to take a little bit of time to see the results of these labors, but, you know, it looks like a good package to help move forward. So.
Thank you, Jim. Any questions? Yes, anyone else?
Some legislators are just going to say, so what? I mean, why is this important? I mean, that's the job I think that we have. And when I talk to people about this, they sort of look at me with a kind of a glazed look that comes over their eyes. And so why is it really important emotionally?
Let me try to make one clear point. I've been in high technology all of my career, more years than I'd like to admit. One characteristic of high tech and knowledge-created industries, our number one capital is people. And that capital puts its hats and coats on every day and goes home. So you have an industry that fundamentally doesn't have to be any place. And part of what we're talking about is how do you compete so that our next plant is in Bend, Oregon. So I think there's a different mindset in this industry about wanting to have some help. I'll give you an example. We're an old company in Oregon, older than Tektronix, some of you know. More than 75% of our $500 million in sales are exported from the United States. Our sales into Oregon are virtually zero. I mean, we like it here, and we think that part of the activity that's going on is to try to help us help you understand that we're site independent. And if we don't have a place where people are proud to be and are proud of raising their children and comfortable they can have access to the things they need to feel good about their family, we can't do our business here.
Thank you. You've made your point very well.
Senator Duncan, I just one more point, and Diane had alluded to it, and Jim mentioned that this would be set for election in November of 2002. When I was speaking with Randall Edwards this morning, I think we need to be careful and thoughtful to the extent there is another referendum by the legislature that would match well with this, and I'm not sure what that would be at this point in time, but I think we might want to think about how we couple those and be thoughtful in terms of that, because I think literally there's an opportunity here. This bill, the joint resolution, really has had no opposition whatsoever, and I think it's something that could be a positive sort of vision kind of statement matched with some other bills that we could cluster around. So I think, and I'm not making a suggestion, but I just say I sort of give that to you to sort of be thoughtful about. So, yeah.
Thank you, folks, very much.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm going to ask the next group, Bill Newman and Gordon Hoffman, to come forward. While they're coming forward, I just want to welcome the students from Highland Park School here. We're glad to have you with us today. Oh, okay. And George Pernsteiner and Marcelia Forbes. Okay. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. Okay.
Good afternoon.
Who wants to start?
I will start here. Let me introduce myself. My name is William Newman, and I, with Gordon Hoffman, are fund managers for the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Account. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with the committee today in support of the Senate bills and the joint resolution as well. I feel that these issues are fundamental to the economic vitality of the state. Management of the state's knowledge resources in a sustainable way is critical to the future economic development of the state. Mr. Craven made a point that it will be necessary to put the structure in place for us to reap the fruits, and we'll have to see what fruits this work bears. But I think we can take a look at some other states and some other regions, and we can see what they've done with their resources to give us some idea of what the potential here is in Oregon. And when we look at some numbers from other regions, the numbers are so astounding as to make themselves almost unbelievable. For example, if you look at the employment, high-tech employment in the Bay Area, 37% of that employment can trace itself either to technology out of Stanford University or founders from Stanford University. Similarly, if you look at Massachusetts, 60% of the high-tech employment in Massachusetts traces its roots to MIT. In fact, if you look at the economic impact, if you aggregate economically all the businesses founded out of MIT by faculty, by researchers, by students, and by technologies spawned by MIT, you aggregated that together, it would be within the top 30 world GNPs. So we're talking about a resource here that needs to be managed, needs to be carefully understood by the state. The program that is being talked about here is an integrated program to link economic development with the educational infrastructure here in the state. Quality higher ed system produces and creates knowledge workers, and it creates intellectual property. The technology transfer process prepares that technology for commercialization. It requires the resources to do so, and the Senate bills being proposed here will both enable the university to properly transfer that technology to the commercial sector and also reap some of the benefits via the constitutional amendment that will permit the institutions to hold equity. Finally, The ORTDA, which I represent, provides the link to the private sector by providing capital necessary to create businesses and formulate a business concept, a business plan that can now be invested in by the private sector to create a burgeoning small business, high-tech economy in the state of Oregon. So I fully support these bills, and I would encourage you to support them as well. Thank you for the opportunity to address you.
Good afternoon,
yes.
Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Gordon Hoffman, and I'm also a fund manager of ORTDA, along with Bill Newman. And I also serve as the Director of Technology Commercialization at the Oregon Graduate Institute, and will assist them through their merger. I've had a personal experience with technology commercialization or tech transfer. Those names are synonymous. In working with OGI, for instance, for the last year, they had absolutely no money for a tech transfer function. And I've been serving in a pro bono capacity to assist them in that. But even with that, it's been hard to find money for the patents that come out of the research, and yet there's over $16 million of federal research. I should point out that the federal government, through the Bayh-Dole Act in 1981, allowed the universities to keep the intellectual property from all the federal research, and the preponderance of our research dollars in this state are federal. So we not only have the right to keep the intellectual property and to reap the benefits from that, we also have an obligation from the federal government to commercialize it to the best of our ability. And many states have certainly done better than we have. I had a chance about a year ago to visit the University of Washington's tech transfer office up in Seattle, and their single office is larger than the aggregate of all the offices in the state. And since they actually focused and started to build up their office in 4 years, they increased their base license revenue from just $600,000 to $8 million a year. And many states have actually reaped bonanzas. I've also attended Stanford, and I've watched with interest how they've succeeded, and some of their peak years were over $60 million of revenues, not to mention the equity from the startups that are accruing, and they certainly have spun out many of those. And you're going to read more and more about cases of $50 and $100 million type gains. And I think Oregon has every bit the quality researchers that I've seen anywhere, and I've certainly been in many places around the country. And it's a shame not to spend the time and work with these researchers to help educate them. The Tech Transfer Office doesn't just negotiate licenses. It actually helps and works with the faculty so, for instance, they don't publish and therefore lose their foreign rights and potentially even their U.S. rights. So they have to spend a lot of time inside the institutions, working with them, educating, bringing technologies along. We, ORTDA, will be involved in that process, carrying it still a step further, but the tech transfer offices are down there day by day, and they need to do that job. So I certainly see the opportunity, and I see the willingness, and I see a building higher tech presence in Oregon, and I've certainly been involved in the OGIOH issue, and I have great hopes for that, and I've seen it at many universities. So I strongly urge you to support these bills.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Senator. Could you give us an example of lay people of technology transfer and intellectual property?
A definition?
Or an example or something so that we can sort of personalize it.
Well, the intellectual property is usually in the form of a patent that might be generated based on the research people have done. And this patent can be licensed. In other words, you can say you could actually go out and actively market it. Companies don't come to the campus. The campus has to go to the company. So there's a marketing aspect. The patents have to be prepared. The marketing of the patents have to be done. And then the licenses have to be negotiated. Or in the case of actual spin-outs, and I'm talking about now what the tech transfer people do, in the case of spin-outs, they have to decide on what's the value of the technology and work with the funding sources to define the equity that the university would get, which is also, by the way, passed back to the professors and so forth. And more, by the way, professors look to this kind of an action because they share in some of the economic benefits. And
so, name just a product or, I mean, a specific example or something so that, say, we're on the floor of the Senate doing this and somebody say, well, what's a tech transfer? What's intellectual property?
Well, there's some recent patents, the U of O, that were resulted in a spin-out of a company called Templex. For example, an optical fiber and optical communication. And that's a fairly new spin-out. We've also, in the ORTDA portfolio, we've had spin-outs from OSU, for instance, the fundamental patents in AVI Biopharma. Bill, you recall what some of those were?
Again, it's intellectual property. For example, AVI Biopharma related to a technology that controlled the signaling within cells. Once that was patented, the technology was licensed to a company which then did animal studies and is now in human clinical trials to determine the applicability of those technologies to diseases such as cancer, cardiac disease, and others. OGI, for example, an example there Gordon might be familiar with is in the area of speech technology.
Yeah, we had several patents in the area of speech recognition. Those led to the formation of a spin-out called Fluent Technologies, which in the past 6 months was sold to a company in California called Sensory Systems, although the company still exists in Oregon, and the employees are still here. And we also, in the early days, spun out a company called FEI, which is a fairly large company, and that was technology in electron emitters that ended up in electron microscopes, transmission electron microscopes. A lot of the research is very cutting edge and it's very new, and that allows it to be patented. And then one has to explore the commercial potential. And the potential is always there. This technology area is exploding on every frontier, and now we're faced with the whole biology area exploding, not just information and optical communications, but now biology, and who knows what the next area will be. But it's been growing at an exponential rate, and I expect it will continue to grow through my lifetime.
Thank you. I don't want to rush you. I'm going to start losing some committee members, and I think we're getting close to moving this bill. Do you have something new that you'd like to add very quickly?
Mr. Chair, George Bernsteiner, I think I will rest on what other people have said. Portland State supports this bill.
Okay, thank you, George. Yes.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Orsilia Suniga-Forbes, Vice President for University Advancement at Oregon State University, and we certainly support all these bills. Just very quickly, however, I wanted to tell you about some of the work we've done in the last 3 years through licensing. We have helped a small company in Corvallis, a software company, a small company in Bend in lasers, a small company in Corvallis, an environmental company. In Charleston, Oregon, it was an engineering design startup. Most recently in Corvallis, Tiger Printer, a company that will be doing Braille printers, started by Dr. John Gardner, one of our faculty members, and we're working with him through those initial difficult times of having any capital to get this going. And so my focus is that the benefits, of course, will accrue to the faculty member of the universities, but you can see through these examples all over the state, and especially in the small companies that do create the jobs. And we've made some hires in biosciences recently from across the country. So I think that most of us are really well poised to take advantage of this enabling legislation.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yeah. Questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wants to testify? All right, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 101, 102, and Senate Joint Resolution 17. I'm now going to open a work session on Senate Bill 101, which establishes a higher educational fund. Senator Courtney?
Yep.
Oh, excuse me, Senator Courtney. We have a dash one amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to
Senator Courtney.
Bill 101.
Excuse me, just a second.
The dash two. Mr. Chair, I move, I delete that motion, withdraw that motion, and I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 101.
Senator Courtney moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 101. Is there any discussion?
I do have one question,
yes,
Mr. Chair. On the dash two, where it defines the eligible institution as one as having received 2% or more, I'm just wondering who we're trying to exclude here. Who do we exclude? That's all.
That's the eligible institutions for the 90% of the funding. No one gets excluded because all the other institutions come under a separate part of the funding.
Thank you, Diane.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? Is there any objection to the dash two amendments? Or adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 101 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Ways it has to be referred to Ways and Means.
I thought it said no.
Subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Mm-hmm.
You want to do that? Huh?
Yeah.
You want to do it?
It has to go to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 101 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. The due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate 101 as amendment to the Ways and Means Committee for due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Senate 101 as amended will be sent to the Ways and Means Committee. Closing the work session on Senate Bill 101. Open the work session on Senate Bill 102.
Do we have any amendments? We have dash one amendments.
Senator Courtney moves the dash one amendments on Senate Bill 102. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Dash one amendments will be adopted.
Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 102 is amended to the Ways and Means Committee with its two pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 102 as amendment to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So order Bill 102 will be sent to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. We have before us now close the work session on Senate Bill 102, open the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 17.
Mr. Chair, I don't see any amendments on this. Is that correct?
No.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 17 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Joint Resolution 17 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Senate Joint Resolution 17 will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 17. Now I need carriers.
I'll carry the
first.
SJR 17.
Senator Nelson will carry Senate Joint Resolution 17. Is there anything else to come before the committee? If not, the committee is adjourned. Thank you, folks, for being with us today. Let's hope we make a difference.
See you there, Nelson. I want you to know.